This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm a retired professor of philosophy and religious studies, and I am substituting for Steve today, who's out of town on YMCA business. And we're glad you could join us this afternoon. We have as our guest Dr. Brett Smith, who is the executive pastor of University Church. University Baptist Church and the Baptist Student Foundation here in Urbana. Welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you, Don.
Our topic today is going to be the history of the campus ministry, but we also hope to have some interaction with our listeners on the impact of campus ministries in general and perhaps of the University Baptist Church or the Baptist Student Foundation's impact locally. So we're hoping that you'll join us. We are a call-in program, and if you'd like to talk with us about this topic or with Dr. Smith for the next hour, our number is 333-9455, or you can dial an 800 number, 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Smith, you have been involved in campus ministries for how long?
Well, first as a student, Don, campus ministry has had a personal impact upon me. I actually became more involved in my personal faith as a college student here at the University of Illinois, so I think that really got me started on this track. It wasn't long after leaving university here I decided that maybe being involved in campus religious life as a long-term vocation might be a good idea, and so I pursued some education in order to be here and be able to serve in this way.
Was it by any chance University Baptist?
That's right, yes. I did worship there as a student. The church was affiliated denominationally with my home church, and so mm-hmm. I got involved there.
And you went on and got what degrees?
Well, after finishing a bachelor's here, I did study at our denominationally-based school, which is Northern Baptist Seminary in Chicago, mm-hmm. and I earned a Master of Divinity degree there, which in our tradition is the basis for ordination for pastoral ministry, and from there actually served in my first placement in campus ministry. I served a group at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, which was called United Campus Ministries, and it was mm-hmm. a joint venture of Protestant Christians of four different denominations, and really enjoyed the service and the life there, and got me even more interested, even more started in campus religious work.
It obviously had an impact on your life. Exactly what was that like? I mean, apparently it was sufficient for you to make a career out of it.
You bet. Well, I'm a first-generation college student, and I think like a lot of folks in my shoes, or maybe they're any generation college student, but a young person comes to the university with an open mind and looking for what's true and good in life, looking for teachers and examples and models to teach them, to think about the pros and cons of the things they've heard, and then to sort of own that for themselves and to have a philosophy of life and to have the tools which they build upon throughout life. And so I came, I think, as a seeker to the university. I was in a professional and a technical major, but nevertheless, you get to take plenty of electives. And I think within that search for truth, in going to the various religious organizations and seeing their life, hearing the things they had to say, experiencing different sorts of opportunities, I think it helped a lot in my formation really as a person, as part of the educational experience. And that's really a thesis, if you will, that I bring to this discussion today, is I'm guessing there are listeners out there who have had personal experiences with religious organizations of various kinds. And frankly, I would like to hear from you if you'd be kind enough to call in at some point and let us know about your own experience. I think that would add to the discussion.
Just to reinforce that, we are hoping that you'll call in to talk to us about the impact of campus ministry on your life, if you have any stories to tell. Once again, the number is 333-9455, or you can call 1-800-222-9455. Well, why don't we start off a little bit with, first of all, this is Northern Baptist, not mm-hmm. Southern Baptist. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, Baptist life in America, and the way we are organized together as a church, we don't have some of the formal structures that other groups of Christians have, and really the what we might call the autonomy, the organization, the government of the church is really based on a local level with each congregation. And so that being said, we've had, unfortunately, one of the more fractious pasts as Baptists. By last count, I've heard there are some 75 different denominations within the U.S. alone. But to make a long story short, when Baptist churches began to happen in the colonial U.S., you know, we were in these various geographic regions, and they would form associations. And eventually there was a national convention that happened in the early 19th century. So at that point, there really was one group of Baptists, if you will, in the early United States. There were a number of different views, of course, based upon region, but they were in one fellowship. Unfortunately, however, there was a large social problem in the United States around the problem of slavery, and that was the first division among major division among Baptists, as it was among other Protestants in the United States. So we did split at that time into a Northern Convention and a Southern Convention, and unfortunately, in Baptist life, we have not formed a convention that brings those groups back together.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Southern Baptist Convention apparently is splitting up as well, or has been for quite a while.
Yeah, and of course, in American religious life, generally, or I'll speak for Protestant Christians, there is a lot of theological diversity, and we have that among American Baptists mm-hmm. too. But yeah, I think among a lot of groups right now, there's always some tension about how we continue to be church together.
Mm-hmm. What is special or unique about campus ministry as opposed to traditional ministries? I take it that you really are involved in both.
I am. Thank you. And I think that's a good way to look at it because as we look at the history of campus ministry, we can see there have been a lot of different manifestations of ministry and the shape of the church and the functions of the – I'll speak for the church, but of course religious organizations generally. I would say that my interest in it comes to the uniqueness of the context of the American university, and that is a large research university like this one, the University of Illinois, really almost as a community unto itself. It has a particular sort of culture. It has a particular sort of purpose. And for that reason, I understand Christian ministry as serving people based upon their interests and their needs in a particular place. And so I think then campus ministry takes a unique shape. Of course, it is, predominantly involves and is geared toward young adults, but of course others who resonate with the campus setting. But I think I'd start to define it culturally based upon the unique needs of a higher education community.
Is there something different about University of Illinois culture as compared to where you served in Wisconsin or other places?
Yeah, that's a great great question. I think every place, of course, is unique, and yet generally, as I talk to international students here on campus and elsewhere who are involved in various ministries, there might be something unique about an American research mm-hmm. university. And Stevens Point was not all that different; a bit smaller, but much like this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you deal with a lot of students. About how many do you serve?
Right. Well, our housing ministry at the Baptist Student Foundation, we have four houses, and we hold about 110 students at any given time currently. And then I figure that in any given semester in our church, there are about 150 different persons involved, and I'd guess that maybe 100 of them are undergraduate students and 30 or so are graduate students.
They're not all those who live in the housing.
Not at all. It's a very broad cross-section, and some come to us. I've recently had students arrive internationally just this fall, and they're members of an actual Baptist church on another continent, which I always rejoice. It's just amazing to think about the richness and diversity of that life. And yet not all. As a matter of fact, most would not come from a Baptist background. They just come to our church. They like it, and they get
mm-hmm.
involved.
Mm-hmm. You have mm-hmm. a lot of international students then.
Yeah, we do. As I think to reflect roughly the demographics of the university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you have a more traditional congregation as well, right?
Well, not really. No? We tend to have more of a student-based and young adult-based ministry. Thankfully, we have had some alumni and others who have provided a non-student core for us over the years. But for the most part, it's a student church and really has been since its origin.
So the average age is in the 20s, 30s, what?
Yeah, somewhere in the 20s. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, probably mid to upper 20s.
Mm-hmm. 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 the students, generally speaking, especially undergraduate students, I think are more involved in questioning and searching. They're confronting ideas and new ways of thinking that they haven't before, as you yourself, I'm sure, would testify. Would you say that most of your ministry is focused on ethical, intellectual, spiritual, personal history, or how would you divide that up, let's say, compared to more traditional congregation?
Yeah, sure. Well, and I think that's probably contextualized based upon the particular religion, and in the Christian faith, you know, there are different manifestations of that based upon the different denominational groups. I guess a guiding light for me is, as University Baptist, we try to live a vision of the Christian faith and the Baptist tradition that seems appropriate for a higher ed setting. So, again, I think we try to speak to that particular culture in a young adult community. So we have the practices, the ethical practices, the intellectual practices that go along with our tradition, but again, with a focus upon young adults. I mean, certainly – they're living in a world thinking about things that, there's some universal human experience, of course, that their parents or grandparents would have thought about too, and yet there are some unique things that they think about as they come of age and in the world that they'll face. So I think we try to gear our ministries toward that. And in our church, we have five areas that we focus upon. We focus upon worship and study and prayer and service. And then what we call fellowship, which isn't just social life, although of course that's important for young adults, but really in the Christian faith, the understanding of the brotherhood and sisterhood that we have of being a part of God's family together.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, you do some work with the Urbana Seminary. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. What is it? What is the seminary, and what is it that you do over there?
Yeah, the seminary is a graduate school of theology that's here in town. And what I do personally, very part-time, is assist them in their field education to help ministerial students to reflect upon their practice of ministry. And also, I've taught various classes based upon church history, and the one that I tend to do the most is on the history and practice of campus ministry.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about history?
Okay.
How old are campus ministries, and how did they get started? Do they have them in Europe and other places? Is it unique?
Sure. Well, again, I mean, I'll speak from my own social location predominantly as a Protestant Christian. I also think that generally in the history of the U.S., of course, since prior to, let's say, around the period of the American Civil War, the majority of Christian persons, if they were religious, would have been a part of one of these Protestant and Christian groups. I do think that that has had a large impact on our history. I do think, too, since the United States has been a place where when higher education developed, the persons who led it tended to be of European ancestry, we do need to look to Europe for models of campus ministry. And I really think one can go back to the spread of the Christian church, first through the Roman Empire and eventually throughout Europe, and look at those early learning communities. I mean, congregations themselves would be, of course, interested in literacy and Bible literacy. And then from there, of course, many of the Christian religious orders were interested in education and the copying and transmission of texts and these sorts of things. And so over time, schools did develop there, and they were integrated in the religious life of these religious orders. And then a large movement happened in
schools on college university systems?
Not yet, but something was developing. By 1079, there was by a decree of Pope Gregory VII for cathedral schools. And as large centers of commerce were developing in Europe and the cathedrals were being built, they thought this would be a good idea to educate the clergy primarily. But then with a rise in merchant class, others began to get on board. And we see precursors of universities starting to happen in places like Salerno and Paris and Oxford.
Sorbonne.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then they start to also teach things like medicine and canon law, and then a liberal arts curriculum develops as well. So these are not quite universities yet. That had to happen after guilds were formed after the 13th century or so. And it would work a little bit like this. A scholar would find some scholarly friends and migrate around these cathedral schools in one of these growing cities, and then students would come to learn from them. And eventually, as the guilds are formed, they start to move together in classes, and the universities, as a subset of the church, start to form. And it's thought that during the medieval era, there were somewhere around 80 eventually universities that were established in Europe. Now, were there campus ministries? It seems to me that, again,
weren't the universities themselves ministries?
That's my point. Yeah. Model. I mean, it's hard at that point to really separate the life of the church from the life of higher education in Western Europe itself. And so I think it's important to note as well that the structure of academic life itself often would be patterned after these religious orders and their hours of prayer and their hours of worship. So, you know, within the within the curriculum, within the daily routine, there were works of Christian piety that were a part of that as well.
I'm old enough to remember that if I didn't go to chapel, I would be in trouble.
And was this at a public school, may I ask?
Baylor University.
Okay, wow, all right, all right. Well, and even in public universities up through, say, the 1890s here in the U.S., there was a mandatory chapel in many, and it was not disestablished until then.
Well, I know you there's so much more that you want to talk about, but isn't there, and this is just an impression, isn't the idea of a campus ministry serving a university such as University of Illinois or whatever unique to American culture?
Wow, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about the rest of the world, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this, teaching religion more broadly, world religions. But I do think that something unique happened in the American context, how it all came together, and you know, our understanding of how religion and the civil realm cooperate and don't cooperate, I think, do add an interesting dynamic to things. In my mind, though, there has been an evolution of sorts of how we've arrived at this point. I mean, there's always been this interesting relationship between the two and how education plays a role in all that, because certainly civil leaders thought that education was a good idea for the populace, as did religious ones. And sometimes these overlapped and sometimes they didn't.
To what extent did the development of the idea of separation of church and state in its various forms have an impact on campus ministries in this country?
Well, I think in this country it really starts to evolve in the 9th century. I mean, I think prior to that, if you look at the colonial situation in the U.S., they really inherited, for the most part, the model of Reformed Protestantism. I mean, there were other groups, of course, but it basically worked like this. Whatever colony one was a part of, and I'm speaking here for English colonies, let's talk about just the Eastern Seaboard, but say you're from New England and the largest sect there, Congregational Puritanism, would establish a Harvard College, and this was a group that the citizens would pay taxes to. It would be chartered by the colony, so there really was not an understanding of a church-state separation in that context. Or if you're from the Middle States, it's a Princeton. Or if you're from the Baptist colony in Rhode Island, you know, it's what would become Brown. And if you're Anglican in Virginia, it would be whatever. Mm-hmm. And that tended to be the pattern really until the national period, that the colonial government would back this this religious organization, again saying that not just knowledge but religion would be a good thing. And of course that was even in the Northwest Ordinance. I mean, this place where we reside now, that the early national government thought this was a good idea. But we start to see a bit of a change in the 19th century, really, I think, because of the flourishing of the various sects in American life. I mean, this is a period of great religious diversity and great innovation. And it's also a period, of course, of westward expansion, and there are a number of colleges being planted, and some of them are frankly not very good. So I think at this point, you know, as this subset of larger American life is going on and people are starting to question in the New Republic, you know, how do we do religion in an increasingly pluralistic environment, all of these things start to come into question.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now your ministry is in competition with other ministries, Presbyterian, mm-hmm. Catholic, mm-hmm. Muslim Student Association, Hindu, mm-hmm. and what have you.
Mm-hmm. And as these
very
colleges,
different environment from the colonial era.
Absolutely, where there wasn't as much religious diversity, and again, the civil power would side with a particular sect, whatever was the majority sect. And there is competition on the so-called frontier. I mean, as these new colleges are being established, because they are sectarian colleges, again, still with a government charter, but increasingly understood less as serving a particular region or particular colony and more as serving the denominational interests of a particular group. Now, that being said, there was some remarkable cooperation, amazingly enough, based upon theological similarities. in this evangelization. Reformed Protestants, for example, if they were Congregational or Presbyterian, would actually cooperate together about planting a school in a particular region, another enterprise mm-hmm. they were involved in. But yes, there was a high degree of competition.
Mm-hmm. Your students focus, you say, on five different areas: worship, study, prayer, service, and fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Are these all equally balanced in your ministry, or is there one that's more important than the other, or how do you view that?
Right. Well, I think it varies based upon the particular group.
Students coming on.
Yeah,
the
yeah, from year to year. And what I try to do as a in the Christian tradition, we say a pastor or shepherd of the group, is to try to look at how we believe God is moving in that particular situation, and the interests and needs of these particular students in any given semester or year. And then that seems to set the pattern for where we might focus upon each of those areas. But we actually collaborated and derived those areas from what we feel like are some, as guided by the Bible, some sort of important and universal emphases for Christian groups to be a part of, regardless of their context. And specifically in the Christian Bible, we look to a writing that's called the Acts of the Apostles, and have sort of let that set the guidelines for our emphases.
Mm-hmm.
So in any given year, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to people from our church, and they'll say, well, you know, when I first came to our church, I thought we really emphasized this. And he said, but now I see we're emphasizing this, you know. So it just sort of varies from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But we do try to keep all of those things going at the same time.
Just to bring folks up to speed, if you've just tuned in, we're interviewing Dr. Brett Smith, who is the executive pastor of University Baptist Church and the Baptist Student Foundation. We're talking about the history and impact of campus ministries. And we're hoping that if anyone who is listening has had a particular experience with campus ministry locally or elsewhere that you'd care to share, how that has affected you, that you'll call in. Our number is 333-9455, or you can call 1-800-222-9455. Let me just take a minute here to announce a few things. Steve asked me to indicate that next week, Shaquille Mustafa from Central Illinois Mosque is going to be on this program talking about Ramadan and the meaning of Ramadan in the Muslim tradition. This coming Tuesday at the YMCA at 12 noon, the Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, Renee Romano, I believe it is going to be talking about the very broad and general topic, today's students. You may be interested in going, Dr. Smith, for
that
one.
Great. Mm-hmm.
And then this Friday on Friday Forum, October 5th, Ed Kolodziejczyk is going to be speaking on the topic of Bush foreign policy. Come eat lunch at 12 to 1 at the YMCA and hear Ed Kolodziejczyk talking about Bush's foreign policy. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question for Dr. Smith.
Yes, I do. I would like to ask the young gentleman how he views the church today, since we had AIDS, and which was basically a homosexual-associated disease when it first started, and the church stood silent.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had homosexual marriages, and the church has basically stood silent. And then we have all these single mothers, and the church stands silent.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, if you're not going to stand for these things, there's no point in having a church. And I'm a very strong Christian, but I do not attend church anymore because mm-hmm. I do not find the churches fulfilling mm-hmm. their proper positions. Thank you. I'd like for you to comment on this, sir, please. Thank you so much, and goodbye.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your call.
And first of all, I want to sympathize with the caller about one's disappointment in church. And, you know, certainly I think for many of us, we can look to times where we feel that that the church has let us down. As a matter of fact, with my congregation just this morning, we talked about that a bit, and the fact that we do not not live up to our calling, if you will, and we're not always the people that that we're supposed to be. I'm interested in the caller's personal history as well, because I hear there a concern for the Christian Church's interest in and statements about social issues broadly within people's lives and American culture. And I think looking at it from the topic of the history of campus ministry, we can see various times, various eras and decades where there might be a bit of vacillation, where the church seems to engage more publicly in culture in institutional ways, and other times seems to not be as involved. It seems to become more of a privatized thing. My personal opinion is that church, whether campus or anywhere, when it's good, is involved in both. There is a privatized and personal dimension where persons are edified in their own life, but also together as what Christians call the body of Christ, we can love the world and engage in such a way that that we serve. I would just like to mention some of the issues that you lift up. There's a national campus ministry group in the United States called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and they hold a conference every 3 years. It's called the Urbana Conference. It used to actually meet in our community. It's a worldwide missions conference to help serve the world. And most recently, they've been meeting in St. Louis. My understanding was at their last meeting, and I did not attend, they did ask the students there, over 20,000, I understand, to get involved both locally or maybe even in international work with help for persons who suffer from AIDS. And I know that I've had some persons in my own congregation, some of our students who have done work here on campus to try to help with that particular ministry. I'd also answer to the caller that my personal opinion is that one of the downsides of being a Protestant Christian is that it is difficult for us to speak with one authoritative voice. I remember a while back I was listening to a lecture here on the university, and someone asked about the war in Iraq, why evangelical Christians have not spoken, you know, loudly and together where they stand with the war. And what I took away from the discussion there was is it's really difficult for Protestant Christians to do that because we are in so many different denominational groups, and it's difficult for us to speak with one voice together. I do thank the caller for your comments, and again, you know, my apologies for your feeling that the church has let you down.
It is true, isn't it? The idea of a Baptist pope is an oxymoron, isn't it?
Well, probably every local pastor like myself probably thinks we're our own pope, unfortunately, sometimes. But that is true. It is hard for us to speak in voice.
You mentioned a downside. The Southern Baptists spend a lot of time valorizing priesthood of believers, and I'm mm-hmm. sure the Northern Baptists do too, because it's part of the Baptist tradition, the sense of individualism and reliance on personal conscience. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you get a call like this and the question is, what does the church right. have to say about this, creates some very interesting tension, doesn't it?
You know, it does. And Don, I think historically, I'll add this too, if I may, that I think generationally, our church life is impacted by larger cultural factors. I mean, when I talk to our alumni who are of the, you know, were college students in the 1950s and 60s, they tend to think, I think, in what, larger ways, larger senses of organization, having more of a public attitude. The mm-hmm. students I talk to today, I think the think globally, act locally mentality has also affected church life. And so it's not that we don't care about persons elsewhere. It's just that maybe we feel like we don't have as much agency, or that our calling is mm-hmm. to take care of what's going on in our own backyard. And so, again, I see these things as ebb and flow and pro and con of human life and how church interacts with society mm-hmm. more broadly.
How has the Northern Baptist Church handled these contentious issues of homosexuality in the church, membership, and also leadership on the part mm-hmm. of gays and lesbians mm-hmm. within the church? I know it's certainly created a great deal of trouble within the Episcopalian and the Lutheran mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Southern Baptist tradition.
Well, we have many of the same things going on. I mean, our communion is not as large as some of those groups you've mentioned, so we don't receive the press. I do think Baptist life is a bit unique maybe from some of the others because, again, as I mentioned earlier, we We put authority within the local congregation. And we're not, as some Christians are, a creedal group. We don't have statements of faith that are binding for all the churches to belong to a particular convention. Now, that being said, there has been in Baptist life, I think, an amazing amount of consistency doctrinally, despite the lack of creed. What has tended to cause division among us is, as I mentioned earlier, social issues like slavery. This issue today, as you mentioned, homosexuality and gay marriage and these sorts of things. So what's happening now in the American Baptist Convention is our local associations are sort of sorting this out, and generally there's a theological agreement locally, but disagreement on a national or worldwide level. So I don't claim to be a prophet in this regard, but I think what will happen in Baptist life eventually, and it might take a few decades, there will probably be a theological realignment across the various conventions.
As your constituency and church constituencies today, younger or older, demographic change and cultural change is bound to happen. Do you see that occurring?
I do, and I also think that younger people today don't bring a strong denominational identity with them as they're looking for a church. I think they're looking more for an experiential dynamic. I mean, there are some that these identities are influential and important, but for the most part, people are, it's pretty permeable, and I think that speaks to these sort of situations about how we associate and how we make these sorts of decisions together.
Just one more time, if you'd like to call in to talk to Dr. Smith about campus ministry, its history, and its impact on your life, call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit about this issue of denominations and their impact on the growth of Protestantism in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Non-denominational groups apparently are the fastest growing, if you can use the term, Protestant outgrowth, as I understand it, in the country today. And the average age is younger than the mainline traditional denominational congregations. And you just indicated that denominational allegiance, you might have implied, is less strong among the young people today than it once was.
Mm-hmm.
How is that changing your ministry?
Yeah, great question. I've read in our history about what our pastor did in the 19-teens, and every afternoon the Baptist students would line up outside of the pastor's study because they were Baptists and come for counsel. And so I also read a document recently where our ministry identified itself, I think this was in the 1930s, as here to serve the approximately 1,000 Baptists at the University of Illinois. I really don't know how many Baptists are at the University of Illinois.
I was just getting ready to ask.
Yeah,
Well,
it's hard to count, I guess, because we change from day to day, right? But we just don't have that information. And it's just a completely different day. And how does it affect our ministry? I think that folks come without a religious tradition in that sense. I mean, broadly, we have a Christian faith and we know about its essentials, but we don't know how that has been enfleshed in particular religious groupings, over time, and we don't know what those customs are. So a big part of my ministry is really starting with the basics and telling that story. I assume that...
Of the Baptist tradition.
Yes, and really of the Christian faith generally. There's a... Stephen Prothero has recently published a popular book where he talks about religious illiteracy entry and, the lack of having the cultural knowledge of the Bible or the Christian faith. So, I often say to people, hey, it's not rocket science, but a big part of what we do is, let's read the Bible, let's talk about it, let's talk about how Baptists have interpreted these religious texts and how we've lived together and how we've, worshiped, studied, prayed, served, and had fellowship, and let's go from there, and then it's about graduation time, and we start over.
They're gone. we have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. What's your question for Dr. Smith?
Well, hi. This is a comment, not a question. I liked this program very much because although we had three boys, they all came out differently in terms of their religious faith. And I think probably that's the way it is now because we're living in very different times. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted the comment of the professor, the guest. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Well, let me just glum on to that a little bit. I was going to ask you, there are those who are concerned, Pro Thoreau and his notion of declining religious literacy is an interesting case in point, about religious preferences becoming more aesthetic than ethical or spiritual, and that a cafeteria model seems to be emerging. You pick and choose based upon your taste and preference rather than upon sense of obligation or ethical commitment. Is that a generalization that makes any sense to you?
Yeah, I think it does, and I think it's symptomatic of our educational system generally. I mean, I think it bears directly upon campus ministry and campus ministry's role. I mean, we've talked about inheriting a system of higher education, a tradition of higher education that is based upon religion and the intellect being wed together in this sort of economy of a shared life.
Mind and spirit.
You bet. And then we start to question that, or I don't know if we question it. My read on the history is, again, that with pluralism came a difficulty in understanding, you know, how do we do this? Mm-hmm. And there's something really significant, I think, that happens in U.S. life in the 1870s or so, and that is that, you know, you mentioned contemporary non-denominational life. Historians will say that the 19th century was really the era of the voluntary organization and the flourishing of the denomination as we know it. And so church life differs in this way, and these groups are growing. At the same time, though, these large research universities are beginning to be established, and that changes the dynamic generally.
Let's pick up on that very good point.
Okay.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. What's your question for Dr. Smith?
Hi, I wanted to bring up something that you had talked about earlier. I missed a portion of your program, but in the beginning you were talking about the early Christian influence on universities in Europe. And I wanted to sort of bring up from another dimension, in India, there were large numbers of Buddhist universities that developed in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century Common Era, which flourished until about the Muslim invasions in the 10th, 11th century. And these were, as you were saying, non-denominational in the sense that they included many different denominations of all of Buddhists, because that was the dominant religious, culture then. But these universities started a tradition which in many ways are similar to what you talked about in the early Christian tradition of the university and the religious life being intermingled and being joined, and the religious life being just a part of the university life and the university life being part of the religious life. So I'll just bring that up from another dimension and let you talk further about it. I think it's especially apropos given what's going on in Burma these days with the government interference in the monasteries, which are also a form of university there.
Thank you for your comment.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. I was hoping that callers like yourself would talk about some other place, other context. I was wondering, too, if there are any who might be knowledgeable about the Islamic world and the situation of higher learning there, because my assumption would be that much the same phenomenon would happen. And I think it also would be interesting to compare these different movements and then to say, you know, how does that bear on our situation today? You know, what did happen in order to get to the point where we are, where campus ministry, I think, in this newer context, is there, but in a different sort of way than it was in some of the earlier eras.
Well, we've had our persecutions here in the United States from time to time, where our religious groups were dispersed, even run out of states. Certainly we have that history, perhaps less so in this day and age. Well, let's... I'm curious to pursue this issue of university and the church that you were talking about just before the last caller, the large university, state university such as University of Illinois, is such a sprawling, huge entity that its prerogatives seem to have become overarching compared to that of church and other spiritual institutions. And it looks to me, is this a fair generalization, that there's been a flip-flop in the history of influence, church, university, university, church, and now we have a situation in which churches and church ministries are servicing as opposed to guiding the university. We have a large land-grant university, the University of Illinois, and thousands of students, no doubt, never come into contact with the sort of ministry that you have to offer.
Right. I think you make a great point. I read recently where someone argued that if you look at the most influential organizations in Western culture and the ones that also tend to change the least, they are universities. And of course, as a religious leader, I stop and I ask the question, wow, you know, that's an interesting way to think about that when when the religious organizations predate the universities, and one would think that they would pass on a tradition, if you will, that might stand the test of time. But certainly we are blessed with all of the learning and teaching that goes on in our universities. They are a different context from what religious persons have seen in the past. And I think you're quite right, Don, that there's actually been a lot of scholarship about this in the last 10 or 15 years. And I think a consensus view is that the religious organizations have lost a privileged role and a privileged place within the universities and have become more involved in an auxiliary way and in a peripheral way. And among historians, and especially church historians, that's still being debated. But
do you find that frustrating, or do others in your work?
I think, I mean, again, to me, it's always a mixed bag, you know. I think there are people who see the pros and cons to that. There are some who would say that voluntary religious life is always far more authentic. And, you know, you mentioned mandatory chapel and these sorts of things aren't always that beneficial if one doesn't want to participate in them. But there are others who would argue that by allowing some of these institutional controls to happen, that, you know, we don't have a place at the table, so to speak. Personally, I am beginning to think, though, that like a lot of things in history, it wasn't a conscious decision on, you know, someone's part or some groups of persons' parts. It was a sequence of occurrences.
An evolution of
absolutely
culture.
Social factors and decisions that were made, turning points that folks did not know would necessarily have the repercussions that they had. And I mentioned, for example, this huge change, I think, in the 1870s and on about the large research universities that, you know, really they're more interested in utility than piety. They are about research and the production of goods and trying to make life better in that sort of way. But, you know, they're usually public. They're not
secular versus the sacred.
Absolutely. And so we have the campus ministries come in the same way that they're already operating in the 19th century United States through these interdenominational societies. And specifically, the first what we might call parachurch ministry is the College YMCA and the College YWCA. And this is a group that emerges out of the larger YMCA movement, which was founded as Europe and North America was becoming industrialized. It was a place for young people, first young men and later women, to leave the farm, go to a city, try to rise as a worker of some kind, have a place to live. This was imported to the campus setting beginning in 1858 and began to grow from there.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question for Dr. Smith.
Yes, two questions. Could you say a little bit more about the collaboration that your campus ministry does with, I believe the name of the organization is Religious Workers Association? That's question one. And two, are you familiar with the model in Ontario, Canada, where especially like the University of Waterloo, where there are church colleges on the campus of the University of Waterloo who are like work like a residential, mostly residential service, but also offer courses Mm-hmm. If you have ever looked at that model, and I mean, do you offer courses at your foundation? I'll close now and listen.
Thank you for your comment.
Great questions. Yes, thank you. First, about our collaboration with Religious Workers Association. Yes, I am personally a thankful member of the RWA.
Why don't you describe it for those who
don't
know what
thank
it is.
You. I think if you look at your archives, I saw where someone did a program on that. I think Rob Kirby, my colleague, who's currently the president of RWA. It's Religious Workers Association, been around for a number of years. We relate with the Dean of Students Office. We're a part of the Student Services here at the university, and we're thankful that the university has extended an invitation for groups like ours to cooperate as someone who offers religious experiences to students. We meet together as interfaith religious leaders once a month and talk about how we can serve together here at the university. So it's a great group. I've been involved in it my time here, and I'm, again, thankful to be a part of it. And our ministry tries to cooperate with that group as much as we can, as do most of the ministries on campus. Regarding the Canadian situation, I'm glad that you brought that up. And my understanding of the English situation, at least in the old colleges, is a bit similar. And my understanding of the history and the evolution of those is this, that at, say, in Oxford, for example, the various religious groups would start their own college, and then these colleges came together eventually to be one university. But to this day, they remain, I understand, as separate institutions. Students can take classes with the various colleges, but they reside there. So, for example, we do have a Baptist college at Oxford called Regent's Park, where Baptist students can come and live, and the majors that are offered by that college tend to be in the humanities and theology, of course, but they can take classes more broadly throughout the university. I'm not personally as familiar with the Canadian model. My understanding is it's somewhere between the one in the old colleges in the UK and what we would find in the United States, but I think it holds a lot of promise. I'll speak, you know, briefly from my own experience. Number one, my doctoral studies here in the United States were in a program that involved a major research university, but also a theological seminary, who had a relationship together historically, but were still separate institutions. And I thought that bore a lot of fruit because when I took classes in the university history department, for example, we didn't have to have this faith stance, and that added a unique dynamic to the study. But at the same time, the seminary was there to do theology from the perspective of faith. So personally, I think that would be fruitful in a higher ed setting. Our own ministry, the Baptist Student Foundation, when I'm trying to describe it to people, I often say we're sort of like a little Baptist college in the middle of the university. We have housing for students. We have worship for students. We have service opportunities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing we don't do is class, at least for credit.
Well, it raises an interesting question, this caller's comment. Do you see on the horizon some direction for campus ministries in general moving toward the Waterloo model or the university model that you would like to see happen? What are the rough edges that you'd like to see campus ministries develop into?
Well, I think we need to
get away from, sorry.
Sure, yeah. We need to look at, there really is a lot of diversity in higher education within the United States. So I personally don't see a large public research university adopting a model like that. I mean, I think the mission is to serve the state, and therefore, in the U.S. context, we have to honor that separation. So I think we'll continue to see the large diversity of ministries that we see. I think campus, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is a great illustration of how that's manifested, because what we see is, Steve Shoemaker, our host, he's the director of the YMCA. That was one of the greatest of that movement I mentioned that started in the 1850s. It was on campus here as early as 1870, I believe.
Alicia Banks is the director of the YWCA, which is one of the first, if not the first, in the country.
Mm-hmm. And so,
student YWCA.
Absolutely. And so, we have that tradition here, and then we see the next tradition develop, which is that the denominations themselves begin to establish campus churches, and we have that here in the organization I serve. We see it in the Wesley Foundation, McKinley, and others, the growth of the Hillel. All of these things mirror these larger movements in history. And then we have, Don, after the American, not just the American, but the Second World War, we have among Protestant Christians, at least, what's called the neo-evangelical parachurch boom. And here we start to see ministries like InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and Campus Crusade for Christ and the Navigators and others begin to campus ministry in a way that is a bit like the YMCA, but never having the institutional access that the YMCA and YWCA had. In the first two decades of the 20th century, someone who recently published a book says that over one-fourth of all male students in the United States were members of that ministry. And its general secretaries really functioned as unofficial chaplains for the universities themselves. I mean, they had access to the deans and the presidents and whatnot. I don't see that day coming back. I think personally the more recent movement that we're starting to see is that large congregations in a particular town are establishing campus ministries, both with a presence on their own campus and also on site on the campus. I think we'll continue to see a non-denominational and parachurch growth, at least among Christians, among Protestant Christians.
Why is that? Let me ask that in the context of all these books that pick up on this motto, the end of this, the end of that, is the end of history. More recently, Sam Harris is the end of faith. Some speak of the end of ideology in a capitalist free market era. What place is there for campus ministry in a culture where speaking truth to power, the prophetic side of Christianity, seems to have been muted or muffled compared to the more personal individual service?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, it dawns on me as I'm having this conversation. I mean, again, I'm speaking of my social location as a Protestant Christian. I mean, we haven't talked about Roman Catholic campus ministry. We haven't talked about, you know, Orthodox. We haven't talked about other religious groups.
They've been represented on this program several times.
Okay, great. And of course, I think relate institutionally maybe differently, because there's something about Protestant life that, as we said earlier, tends to be a bit fractious. And I see us continuing to have group after group after group, and yes, cooperating together through groups like RWA and others, but not necessarily being able to have the unity or the direct influence within a public university. What is our purpose then? I do think that there will be a continued need to meet personal needs of students. You know, it's my belief, Don, that a number of students who are involved in a large university like this unfortunately don't get to relate as directly to university life as maybe we'd hope. They might not necessarily befriend a professor. They certainly won't get to know their department head usually. How do they relate to the university? Well, you know, going to a large class, being a part of sporting events, hopefully being a part of a club. That's where I do see a purpose for campus ministry, as a bridge in student life, in student development. And as far as addressing larger social issues, you know, we don't claim the cultural privilege that our ancestors did, and yet I think that in the good news of the Christian faith, as we understand it, what we are about is ministry, a word that means service. So if we can assist persons in the university, that's what we'd like to do. I mentioned the early campus YMCA movement. One thing they did before there were student service departments is they help students find jobs. They help students find housing. They help students move in. They unpack their cars. Well, I guess they didn't have cars in the 1870s, but you know what I mean. These are the sorts of things that we can continue to do today as we serve.
Do you have any individual stories that you could tell, without mentioning names, of success with your ministry, and any students who have been turned around or discovered things they haven't before that you could personalize?
I think a large theme that maybe is important for me is that we do provide, in a setting like this, I think, a theological education that by the nature of American higher education one can't have. Certainly, there are wonderful ways to learn in religious studies, and yet, as I understand the discipline of religious studies, one cannot take a stance of faith in the sense that, you know, I have to believe this, or this is really what I want to believe.
Academic religious studies in a...
Exactly.
Public institution.
Exactly. So what we can do in religious organizations is sort of supplement that learning here. And some of the joys that I have seen are persons, of course, who answer religious vocations through their involvement in campus ministry. And I think that we could probably look at a variety of religious traditions and see that many of the leaders emerge from a setting like this. So I don't think we go about day-to-day thinking we're recruiting in that sense, but we do see that happen. Another thing important for me personally is helping students to integrate their faith with their larger life, to understand these as a whole, not just a compartmentalized way of being. So I think we have an educational function as well.
Well, we don't. We just have a couple more minutes here, but integrating faith with one's personal life or larger life certainly seems to be tougher these days with the campuses struggle, the administration struggle with drugs and alcohol, the larger dispute over the war.
Mm-hmm.
Broader topics of consumerism, democratic involvement. Mm-hmm. Do you touch on those social issues, or do you stick to more narrowly personal issues?
Absolutely, we do. And what I'm finding in student life today is there really is a lot of political and philosophical diversity. I mean, students can share a lot of the same religious beliefs and yet apply those in different ways. And when we add the international dynamic to our ministry, we see a lot of diversity there. So our method tends to be, again, we look to our holy writings as we understand them, and as they bring these things to mind, we try to figure out how they come to bear on our contemporary situation.
Mm-hmm. And by holy writings, you mean New Testament and Old Testament?
Correct,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That how Christians understand the Bible. Mm-hmm.
How have you dealt with the war with your students? Have you helped students deal with it? Do you have any veterans, any returnees?
We do. We have some who continue to serve in places that are at war. You know, we have students who come from other places in the world who don't agree with U.S. policy. We have mm-hmm. students from the U.S. who don't agree with U.S. government policy. Generally, these have been addressed in our small group Bible study settings. And, of course, I've had plenty of one-on-one conversations with students about how they feel about military service and, mm-hmm. You know, their own life and involvement in that.
Well, we should wind up here. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Smith.
You're welcome.
We have been talking to Dr. Brett Smith, who is the executive pastor of University Baptist Church and the Baptist Student Foundation. We've been talking about the history of the campus ministry and its impact on the lives of students here. How long have you been here?
I'm in my eighth year.
Your eighth
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
One more announcement here. Next week, we'll have Shaquille Mustafa from Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. Topic is Ramadan. Next Tuesday at the YMCA at 12 noon, the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, Renee Roman, will be talking about today's students. And Friday Forum's topic is Bush's Foreign Policy by Ed Kolodziejczyk, October 5th. So we hope to see you there. Thank you very much for joining us on Keeping the Faith. And my name is Don Dolan. Hope to see you again next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Are you an experimental innovator who works by trial and error and is most creative later in life, like Cézanne? Or are you a conceptual young genius like Picasso? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore a theory that those are the two life cycles of artistic creativity. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
The Sears Tower, the Great Pyramids, the Statue of Liberty, these are all big things. One thing that's not on the list, WILL's pledge drive. In fact, our pledge drives have been getting smaller and smaller each year, all thanks to you and the Power Hour. During the Power Hour, we'll raise a full day's worth of pledges in 1 hour. That way, we can cut down on the length of the pledge drive. So tune into the Power Hour, 7 a.m. Thursday, October 11th, and keep pledge drives as small as possible.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with isolated showers and thunderstorms this evening, then scattered showers and thunderstorms after midnight. The low in the lower 60s with south winds around 15 miles per hour, gusting to around 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny and cooler with a high in the lower 70s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour.